Please join me in welcoming our speaker tonight, Sheldon F. from Las Vegas.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sheldon Fady. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Las Vegas. I belong to a home group that's very similar to this group. We're a speaker meeting that meets on Thursday night, about the same size, similar kind of format. We're also a group that meets during the week many, many times, and we believe that our Thursday night meeting, much like your Saturday night meeting, is a celebration of sobriety. And that's what I'm here to do tonight, is to celebrate my sobriety. And congratulations to the people that took chips and cakes. Happy birthday. Welcome the newcomers. This is really a neat, neat deal. Let me tell you a little bit about myself and where I come from. I was actually born in England, in the north of England, in a small city called Leeds, to parents that are not alcoholic. I don't have alcoholic parents, don't have alcoholic grandparents, no alcoholic uncles, no alcoholic pets, nobody in my family. The house wasn't built by an alcoholic. There's no alcoholism anywhere in the family. But when I was 2 years old, my dad upped and left, and I went from being a kid in an average middle-class family. We were Jewish, and we moved to a non-Jewish neighborhood. We moved into government-subsidized housing. And it was just awful. I just hated growing up. I hated being me. I was an awkward, short, fat kid, Jewish by birth, in a non-Jewish neighborhood, and I just hated it. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you would have asked me, I'd have told you that if you lived like I lived, you grew up the way I grew up, you felt the way that I grew up, you'd have drank too, for crying out loud. It was just awful being me growing up. And I hung my very existence on the fact that I had a poor, pathetic, miserable childhood, and therefore I drank. And if you want to, it's just the way that I felt when I got here. One of my first lessons when I got here was that there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous that actually had the childhood that I believed if only I would have had, that they were just as alcoholic as me. My wife, and I know we don't like to say anybody is alcoholic, but I think I'm safe in saying that my wife is every bit the alcoholic that I am. She grew up in the kind of home that I would have loved to have grown up in. Her parents were married the whole time. They had boats, and they had a private plane, and they lived in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, for crying out loud. I mean, this came out of a storybook. And I got to take off that peg that I hung my life on, the reason for my existence. My first resentment when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was, well, if it's not because of that, then why? And the truth about my childhood is that there are people here tonight and people who are not alcoholic that had much worse childhoods than I did. There are people, not alcoholic, that were beaten, thrown in closets, burned with cigarettes, wrapped with extension cords and left in a cellar. People that were abused emotionally, physically. And you know what the worst thing is that happened in my childhood? The worst thing about it? It happened to me. If it would have happened to you, I would have said, get over it, for Christ's sake. Right? But it was happening to me, and anything that happens to me is worse than anything that could happen to you. I mean, surely you've got a sponsor and steps for your problems. Mine are real deep issues. I remember when I had my first drink, which is strange in itself, because you can look at me and you can see that I quite like Snickers. I don't remember my first Snickers. Don't remember. I know I must have enjoyed it because I had another one, but it was not a great point in my life, you know. But I remember my first drink. It was Old English apple cider, which is fruit juice with a kick. And I was with a kid called Barry Durham, and I was 9, he was 11. We stood in front of a liquor store, and we waited for somebody to take our money and go buy us a bottle. Guy went in the store, came out, brought us our bottle. We went to a small wooded area behind the liquor store, and we drank. And I took a big, big pull on that apple cider, and I kept it down. And what I did next was something that I often did when I drank. I puked it out of my nose. Because I'm a nose puker. Not only do I not have alcoholic parents, but I am not good at drinking. And I'm a lousy drunk. I'm three beers and embarrassing myself drunk. I'm terrible at it. I just am. There were kids at my school that would carry a pint in their back pocket or in their school bag, and they'd take pulls on it all day at school. And I tried that once, but I was busted by second period because I'm a lousy drunk. But I remember being in that wooded area, and I took that drink, and after I wiped it up my face clean, it felt to me like something was happening inside of me that was wonderful. I felt the magic of alcohol come over my body for the first time. I was short, fat, big-nosed, awkward Jewish kid in a non-Jewish neighborhood from a divorced home. And it was almost as if I grew 6 inches. Almost as if I lost 50 pounds, as if my nose shrank, my parents got remarried, and my foreskin grew back. It was just... It was magic. And I could not drink whenever I wanted to, but I drank whenever I could, and I loved it. And I did, and I was about 11, and somebody introduced me to marijuana, and I just loved that too. And next thing you know, they introduced me to magic mushrooms, and shortly after that, it was meth. And I tell you, I am an alcoholic. I'm not alcoholic and anything. Because if you're alcoholic and something, you have to put $2 in the basket, and I'm not up for paying twice, so I'm only an alcoholic. But alcoholics shouldn't do drugs. We shouldn't. I take everything to the wall. I just, whew, when you're supposed to stop, I have to stop. What are you, nuts? Woo, I go, and I took it all to the wall. And I loved it. I loved it, and I just enjoyed it, and it was fantastic for me. And I was 16 years old, and I left the north of England, and I moved to live in Orange County, California. And I got there, and I was scared to death. But I found some people right away. One of the magical things about being a kid that's drinking and that's doing drugs is that we're able to seek each other out. Part of the magic of being a drunk is that I can go anywhere when I was drinking in the world, and I can find the drunks, and it's like my long-lost friends are there. Not much has changed. You know, I got sober, and it's the same thing in that respect. But I got there, and I found the people that were partying, and I started to party, and I loved it. I loved everything about drinking. There was nothing about it I didn't like. I heard a guy from a podium one time say, and it confused the living daylights out of me. He said that his very, very worst day sober was better than his best day drunk. Yeah. And I thought, what were you drinking? Crying out loud. I have had some wonderful times drinking. I remember one time I came from Orange County to the Shoreline Amphitheater in San Jose. The Grateful Dead were playing. And I love it when I was window pane and just, woo. And I tell you, it was one of those days where it's kind of cloudy, but not really, and kind of not really raining, but just damp, you know, and the wind was blowing, and it was just perfect. And I was as high as a kite, and I was dancing up on the back, and the band's playing. And I have had some spiritual moments sober. None quite as good as that day right there. That was a spiritual experience, the likes of which no Fifth Step has ever given me, you know? And me and God were on this. If it would have stayed like that, I'd have kept going, boy, because I loved it. I turned 22 or 23, and I started to think, you know, I'd always told myself that as I get a little older, I'm going to pull my socks up. I'm full of potential at this point. They've been telling me that for a long time, and I'm going to uncork my potential, and I'm going to be somebody. I'm going to go somewhere, and I'm going to put down this crap, and I'm just going to rock it off to be a I don't know, a lawyer or a doctor, I suppose. I'm supposed to be one of the two, right? And I said to my sponsor when I first got sober, how did a nice Jewish boy like me end up with alcoholism? I didn't think we had alcoholism. And he looked me right in the eye and he said, "You're not a nice Jewish boy." Which is probably why I'm neither a lawyer nor a doctor now. But I was going to pull my socks up and I was going to clean up my act and I was going to rock it off to be something my mother could be proud of. And I couldn't stop. I mean, I could stop for a little while. I could put it down for 3 or 4 days. And I could. But it was painful. Something happens to me when I'm not drinking that separates me from the rest of the world, other than people like me, that it happens to. What happens to me is what the big book calls restless, irritable, and discontented, which is, I believe, slightly understated. I love the big book. I am a thumper from the day I got sober, and I love that book. But restless, irritable, and discontented kind of sounds like, you know, something mildly uncomfortable, doesn't it? But it's not that I'm restless. It's just that I am certain that there is something just over there that is going on that is more fun than whatever is going on over here. And this might be fun, but there is something else going on that I should be doing. And it's not that I'm irritable. It's not. It's that you're pissing me off. You know, anybody can see how annoying you are with that constant in and out you do with the breathing. And it's just... I can't take it, for crying out loud. And I'm not discontented. I'm not. My life is a shambles. Discontent. Don't you love it when the guy with the nice car and the jewelry says, "Perhaps you're discontented." You know, and I'm thinking, discontented? My life sucks. I'm not discontented. I have a horrible life. My car sucks, and my apartment sucks, and my job sucks, and my parents suck, and my girlfriend, she won't suck, and that sucks. Yeah, I'm discontented, all right? What I need is a drink. It'll make me feel much better. I'm 24 and I just can't get it together. I'm 25 and I'm a guy that kept getting great opportunities. I started out as a fairground demonstrator selling Ginsu knives at the county fairs. Hard to imagine, isn't it? But wait, there's more. So I started out selling Ginsu knives at county fairs, and because of the earthquake in San Francisco, they moved this show to L.A., and I had to go to L.A. and do this thing for this company. And the next thing you know, I'm the national spokesperson for Kenwood Appliances, and I'm traveling around the country in first-class travel with corporate credit cards, and I'm trying to be this square in this corporate environment. And I did pretty well when I got to live on the West Coast, and they were based on the East Coast because I had to show up for 3 days a month. But then they decided they wanted to enter me in their junior executive program, and they moved me to New York, which was hard because they wanted me to show up. And I'm not a good shower-upper. I'm just not. And there was a guy there called Bernard who he didn't like short, fat Jews. So he began to conspire against me. And he eventually got me fired. It didn't dawn on me that he just didn't want a crack addict for a national spokesperson. Might have looked bad for the company. I assumed it was personal, and they fired me, and I went back to California, and I went to work for this company selling integrated circuits on IC chips, and we were doing pretty well, and there was this guy, Todd, and I think he knew Bernard, because... he got rid of me too. And actually, what happened was when they fired me, they had told me that you're doing a really good job, Sheldon, but you gotta quit coming to work high. And if you can do that, then we'll let you stay. So I did. Because I liked that job and my life was a mess. I had lost every opportunity. I was starting to use up that potential. It was starting to drift through my fingers. And I really wanted to straighten my life up. So I did. And I held on and I didn't do nothing. And when they fired me because I make secretaries cry. Because that's what kind of guy I am in a state of abstinence. I'm angry and I'm short-tempered and I'm frustrated and I got no time for you and your crap and you better do it right, gosh darn it, you know? And I'm just a wreck and they fired me because I made the secretaries cry. And that was kind of a low point for me. I went back to my dad's house and I never was a saver. So I was paycheck to paycheck guy, and when I lost that job, I had nowhere to live, and I went to my dad's house, and he said that I could stay with him, and he said on one condition. He said, I'm not going to ask you not to drink. I know you're going to drink. I'm not going to ask you not to do no dope. I know you're going to do dope. But what I'd ask you to do is not bring it in the house. Come home lit up, but don't bring it in my house. I thought that sounds reasonable. All right? Till 2 weeks later, stood on the toilet, blowing hits of meth into the extractor fan, thinking, my dad's just an ass, you know? And because that's what I'm like. And then he threw me out, which I thought was unreasonable, a little harsh. I had one friend left in the world who let me move into his house. And this guy was kind of a normal guy. This guy was a guy that he didn't party at all. And he let me move into his house. He was kind of a normie type dude, and I'd met him through work, and I went to stay with him and his son. His son was 15, and his wife, and they were just this beautiful little family. And he didn't understand me. He'd come home from work with a 12-pack of beer, and he'd have two beers, and then the other 10 would sit in the fridge for, you know, a week until he wanted another beer, and a 12-pack was something that, if he was hot, he would see if the Pepsi was colder than the beer before he decided what to drink, you know? Just a real wacko. And he came home one night, and I'm going to stop for a second here. You know, in my story, drugs are part of my story. I'm an alcoholic. I have alcoholism. But drugs are part of my story, and I hope that doesn't upset anybody. The only thing I have to offer is my story. And it's just my story, and I did some drugs. And so I apologize if I'm upsetting anybody by talking that I really don't mean to or disrespect the meeting. But he came home one night with a 12-pack of beer and a little bit of speed, and he gave me a couple lines of speed, and he had three beers, and he went to bed. Physically, I was as wound up as him, and if he was able to go to sleep, I should have been able to go to sleep. But I laid down in that bed, and my head started this mantra that it killed me with, Sheldon, there's more. There's more. There's more. There's more. You can't sleep. There's more. There's more. Get up. There's more. There's more. He's doing it and laughing at you. There's more. And the house would settle, you know, and it would creak, and I'd go, there he is, you know. So I knew that I was being played for a fool one more time, you know. He was in construction, got up real early and went for work. His wife left early. His kid was on the surf team for Dana Point High School, so he would leave real early also to go do his sports activities. So it's like 6:30, 7 o'clock, and I'm alone in the house, and I did the only thing that a self-respecting alcoholic can do. I ransacked his room. Now, there are in this room probably some liars, some cheats, and some thieves. I am not one of them. I am not. I have never lied to anybody, stolen anything, or cheated anybody out of anything I did not absolutely need for my own survival. I am a survivalist. And I went into survival mode, and I found his dope, and I'm not. I took a little less than half. Because you can get away with a little less than half. But I went back three times. Now, for those of you that never did no dope, a little less than half times three equals a little more than none. So he came home and he asked me if I'd taken his stash, and I said to him, mm-mm. Wasn't me. Must have been your son. Don't ooh and ah. Did I come to the wrong room? Is this the PTA? Are you growing? Ooh. For crying out loud. But I didn't really say it. Like, I thought I said to him, why, no, it must have been your son, you know, because that's how it sounded to me. But what I really said was, no, man, it wasn't me, man. What makes you think it was me, you know, because I'm a liar, but not a very good one. And he threw me out, which I, of course, thought was unreasonable. And I left. I went to my dad's house, and I was not allowed in my dad's house at this point. I was allowed in the driveway, and my dad gave me a credit card, and he told me that he would put me up in a hotel that night, and then the next night he'd help me get an apartment, because my dad never did find Al-Anon. And my mom did, and Al-Anon is very near and dear to me. But they changed my, they helped my, those ladies and men helped my mom immensely. And I have a very, very close relationship with my mom because of the Al-Anon family groups today that I would not have had had she not found Al-Anon. But my dad did not find Al-Anon, so he gave me his credit card. And I know what he was thinking. He was thinking that I should go hang out with Tom Baudet and check into to Motel 6. But I needed a place to think. So I got me an ocean view in Huntington Beach and ordered some cocktails. What happened as I sat there, though, was for the first time in my life, I got to see me the way that he saw me, the way that I knew he'd see me when that bill came in. The way that Todd had seen me, the way that Bernard had seen me, the way that Chip, my friend whose kid I accused of stealing his dope, had seen me. The way that everybody who got close to me in my life had seen me. I was always the guy leaving. It was always a scene, and Sheldon had to go one more time. And I knew that this was going to be another episode where the walls were going to fall in on me, and it was just going to be ugly. And I started to cry. And I got out the phone book, and I called a different anonymous program, but somehow I got steered to AA, and I went to an AA meeting. And I sat in that room, and I cried. And a little Mexican lady told her story. And we were very different. She's Catholic, I'm Jewish. She was a woman, I'm not. She was little, I'm not much bigger, but a little bigger. She was old, I was young, and she told her story. And Aura D. out of L.A. says that the pain in her reached out and touched the pain in another person. And the pain in that little Mexican lady reached out and touched the pain in me. And for the first time in my life, I heard the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't know what the music of Alcoholics Anonymous is, you've been listening to it tonight. You've been listening to people sigh and laugh and grin and groan. And you've been listening to people have their emotions out in front of them. And that's what I heard for the very first time in that meeting. And I wept. And at the end of the meeting, I wish I could tell you then I got sober for the rest of my life and that's my story, but that's not what happened. What happened was some guy came up to me and asked me what I believe today to be the most stupid question I've ever heard in my entire life. And if you're new and you approach me after the meeting, I might ask you this question, for I don't know what else to say. But he said to me, do you want to get sober? And the answer is no. I don't want to get, what are you, nuts? My life is crap. I have spent all the potential. There is no potential left. My life is over. It is awful. It is horrible. Nobody that loved me wants to be near me anymore. I am depressed most of the time when I'm thinking. What I'm thinking about is finding a way to blow my brains out. My life is horrible. There is nothing good about my life except for one thing. The 5 minutes of anticipation before I get loaded, followed by 5 minutes of relief after I get loaded, before I trudge off to oblivion. That is the only thing that is good in my life. And now you come along, you self-righteous alcoholics, and you want to take that away from me. No, I do not want to get sober. You gotta be kidding. But I didn't say that. Because I needed a cigarette. had a place to sleep. So I said, yes. I want to get sober. And then came a beaut. I couldn't believe there was a better question. But he had one, boy. He must have gone to Stupid Questions of America University. Because then he says, are you willing to go to any length to get sober? I don't know what any length is, but I think it might be homosexual. And that might be your deal, but it ain't mine. And I'm glad that's not what it was, because I said, yes. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says there will come a time in a man's life when he cannot imagine life without alcohol. Next sentence. There will also come a time where he cannot imagine life either with alcohol or without it. He will wish for the end. And that does not sound to me like somebody that wants to get sober or is willing to go to any lengths to get sober. If you're new or if you're returning and you've been in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous feeling alone, feeling cut off, feeling like you're dying here, and some guy has walked up to you and said, welcome back, punky. Are you ready? Ask him if he's read the book. Because the book doesn't talk about being ready. It talks about being at a jumping off place. It talks about being afraid. It talks about not knowing how to live and how to die. It talks about being at that place that I believe all of us were when we got here. And I did not feel ready. And I did not want to get sober. And any lengths was a scary place for me. And I tell you, I was crazy. And I went off to a halfway house and I stayed there for 30 days and I couldn't stand it anymore. Those happy, smiley faces with their do-gooder attitudes, they made me nuts. So I went and had a drink, because that's what I do when I'm nuts. And what came next was about 2 years of the worst part of my life, where I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I got sober for 8 or 9 days and then I got loaded. Then I got sober, and then I got loaded, and then I got sober, and then I got loaded, and then I got sober, and then I got loaded. And people would, at first, they'd love me when I walked in the rooms, and towards the end of the time, they'd look at me and they'd look away, because I scared them. Because those of you that are struggling to go in and out scare those of us that are here, because you're our possible future. And my possible future is scary to me, and I scared them. And I was the guy that people nudged when they walked in the room and they said, stay away from him, to their new guy. Because every 7 or 8 days I went, and then I came, and then I went. And people said things to me like, welcome home. And I just thought, home? Home sucked, and this is worse than home. You know? I don't want to be home. Are you crazy? If this is home, I am in a lot of trouble. And I'm dying inside, and I don't get it. I took a geographic. I moved to Las Vegas, which is kind of a story in itself. The official reason for me moving to Las Vegas was to open a beef jerky factory. You're laughing. This is my life that we're talking about. I had a friend that had graduated UNLV with a marketing degree, and he had a friend that was a chef at one of the major strip casinos, and I'm a salesman of sorts, and we were going to get together and open up a beef jerky factory. We were Vegas strips. We were ready to rock and roll. When I got there, my friend with the marketing degree was such a great marketeer that he was driving a taxi. The strip chef was actually the fry cook at the Horseshoe. And I was afraid to make a sales call by the time I got here. I used to sit in my car and write down imaginary meetings that never happened and then pull out of the parking lot. I was so afraid. We sat around and talked a lot about beef, and I never even tasted the beef. That was in January end of January of 1996. In July of 1996, I walked into a little club in Las Vegas, dead, knowing you guys couldn't help me, but not knowing where else to go. I'd been to AA. I did AA. I did 90 meetings in 90 days, for crying out loud. But that never get me. 90 meetings. What page is that on? Anyway, so I showed up and I laid on a couch in the front of this club and I started to groan, and the lady that was there was me and her and one other guy who was sober quite a while, and they were the only three people in the club, and he was getting ready to leave, and she asked him not to leave. Not because I was a danger to her and she was afraid of me for that reason, because I was a danger to no one, but that she was afraid of what I might do to myself because I was more dead than alive. And I already know that that's true, because years later when I got married, she was one of the maids of honor for my wife, and she stood up at our wedding for us, and she became a close friend, and she recounted that to me. But when she showed up, when I showed up, she begged him to stay, and I just hung out at that club. And I knew it wasn't going to work. But there were these crazy guys. And I'd seen them before. You know, the guys with their blue book under their arm. And they talk about sponsorship. And when the guy behind the counter says, "I got a 12-step call," it's always one of them that wants to take it, you know. And they're always straightening the room before and after the meeting. And, oh, they are so... You know what they remind me of? You know, when I was getting high and it was really working on Sunday morning, those crazy Christian folks would come by with a Bible in their hand and try and preach at me. And I would bring them in the house and we'd just go at it for a couple hours, you know. And they reminded me of those kind of zealots, you know. And I was afraid of them. I didn't want... But they were the only ones being nice to me. Everybody else was kind of staying away, and I was alone, and I was lonely, and I was broken, and I needed people to be nice to me, and they were nice to me. And, you know, I didn't do my steps out of the big book because I thought it would help. I did it because I had a feeling that if I didn't, they'd stop being nice to me. I have a desperate desire to fit in. I have a desperate need to be part of. I have a desperate yearning to be one of the guys. And I was 27 days sober when I shared my fifth step, and I know that's far too fast. At one step a year, you're supposed to be 5 years sober when you get there. But it's one of my first resentments in AA that they pushed me too hard to recover. But I was 27 days sober when I shared my fifth step with my sponsor, and I was 60 days sober when I sponsored my first guy, and I tell you a story about my fifth step that was mind-blowing to me. If you're new and you haven't done your fifth step yet, or your fourth step yet, I should say, can I tell you that we know already most of it? And I know you're sitting there thinking, no, you don't. But we could hand out the list pre-filled in, right? I have a resentment at my mom, my dad, my boss, my girlfriend, my ex-boss, my ex-girlfriend, my brother, and, you know, my friend. And I mean, we just could. We could put the first 10 names, they're free, right? And the first two on there were my dad and my mom. And we talked about my dad. I get to my sponsor's house and we begin the fifth step process and we talk about my dad. And I'm not listening. Because, see, my dad left when I was 2 years old, and that son of a bitch had no right to do that. And my sponsor tried all his magical little, clever little AA cliches, my least favorite of which is, well, you know, your father did the best he could with the tools that he was given. I'm thinking, get new tools, right? You were able to father a child, for crying out loud. Go get new tools. This is not my fault. And he left, and I'm not listening. And we went around for 20 minutes, and we could not get beyond that. So my sponsor did the only thing he was capable of doing. He went to my mom. My mom was a little wacky. She was the kind of person that when I got home, it did not matter what my behavior had been like, she could either love me or be angry with me. And I could not tell based on my behavior what the reaction was going to be when I got home. I put my hand on the door and I go, here goes, let's find out, and walk in. We talked about my mom, and my mom has a disease. It is different than alcoholism, but it is nonetheless a disease. It says in the big book that the people that offended us were perhaps sick. And my sickness is a different sickness than my mom's, but is equal in its depth. And my sponsor said to me, you know, you did some things when you were out there running around and you hurt some people for which you are not guilty. You are responsible, but you are not guilty. And you probably feel like you need a little forgiveness, right, Sheldon? Because, you know, you did these things under the duress of a disease and it's not your fault. And I'm, yeah, I want some instant forgiveness. I'm up for that. And he said, you're entitled to it, but only if you're willing to give it. And your mom had a disease different than yours, but you have to be willing to forgive her for being sick. It is no more her fault. She was sick with her illness than you were sick with yours. And I got to let my mom off the hook. My mom, since then, had gone and gotten some medication that kind of calmed her down long enough for the psychiatrists and the medical doctors to help her. And you can tell she's not an alcoholic because she quit taking the pills. Because that crap's not designed to be taken for more than 16 weeks. It just isn't. Now, I'll climb off my soapbox now, I know. Probably made a few people mad. But anyway, so now she's, I'm looking at her and I can see that maybe I need to let my mom off the hook, and I cry a little bit about my mom and I get to be okay with my mom. And he says, let me ask a question about your dad. And I go, oh, here we go. What about my dad? And he said, what do you think it was like for your dad to live with your mom? Now, my mom and dad got together in the 50s in a small community, a small Jewish community where it wasn't, Judaism wasn't like it is today in the north of England in the 50s. It was a very different deal. And it was a very small community, and you met somebody very quickly and you married them very quickly and then you had kids very quickly. And he said, is it possible that when your mom and dad got married, your dad woke up one day and went, oh, this is not good. But she was pregnant with your older brother. So he stayed and did the best he could and did the right thing and stuck with her until she was on her feet and could possibly be okay with a small child on her own. But then she got pregnant again with you. I suppose it's possible. Is it possible that she stuck around as long as he could till you were two and your brother was four, and then he had to leave? And he didn't go around the corner where they could still be drama. He left town. He moved first 300 miles away to London, then he moved to Southern California. Is it possible that he did that in order to defend your mom's honor? Well, it's possible. Is it as possible, because we don't know the truth, is it as possible as the garbage and cancer that you've been carrying around with you? It's as possible. They, like ourselves, were sick too, though we did not like their symptoms or the way they disturbed us, that they, like ourselves. Is it possible, Sheldon, that if you were in your father's shoes, you would have taken the same action, right, wrong, or indifferent? Is it possible that if with the same fears, the same problems, the same upbringing, the same environment, the same concerns, and the same life, that you could have made the same decision and taken the same action? And that's a dirty pool, because when I was 16 years old, I stuffed a bag full of newspaper, put some old dirty clothes on top, went down to City Hall and claimed my mother had thrown me out and asked him for a check to get my own apartment. I left home as an emancipated adult at the age of 16 years old, and where I went was to my father's house, because I would rather live with an asshole than a bitch any day of the week, because I ain't stupid, right? They, like ourselves, are sick too. See, when I took the fifth step with my sponsor and went over the narrative, and this was our cause, the most powerful part, in my opinion, of that big book. When I went over this was our cause out of step four through the step five process, I got my mommy and my daddy back. And that might not be a big deal to you, but it's a big deal to me. And it's a big deal to my mommy, and it's a big deal to my daddy. And we're a family again through the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is a miracle. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me in my life. That's who came in here, and that's who AA has begun to spit out. Today, I'll tell you something. Today is so far from the guy that came into Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes I don't even recognize him. I came here and I was unlovable. And today I am, first of all, loved, which is a miracle on its own. But most of all, I am able to love. My sponsor taught me to love people, and I thought he was doing it so I could feel loved back. And one day I said to him, "What's the miracle here? I'm being loving." He said, "Aha, there's the miracle. You're being loving." And I went, oh, that's the deal. I got plugged in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found a God that I could live with. I couldn't live with the God of my father and the God of my mother. I couldn't live with that God. They teach a loving deal, but I couldn't hear about the love. I could only hear about the punishment and the guilt. So today, that's not my God. My God today, I don't know his name. I don't know his face. I don't know what day of the week he would prefer that I worship to him on. I don't know what language he wants me to speak to him in. I don't know his favorite song. I don't know when his birthday is. I don't know any of that stuff. I just don't. I really don't. I am very limited in my connection with God in that respect. I struggle with that. I only know one thing about God, and that is that God loves me and cares about me and has carried me from the depths of depression and suicide and a broken person to the man that stands before you today. And I have no other proof that God exists other than that. And if you're new, and I stand here and I tell you the story of my life, most likely one of two things is going to be true. You're either going to believe that I never, ever felt the way that I have described that I felt growing up and as I got sober, and that maybe I read it in some kind of book or something, and I've come here now on some kind of goofy, weird deal, I can't imagine what, you know, and my life is good today, and I'm some kind of weird do-gooder, or my life is still crap, and I rented this suit, and when I go home, I'm going to beat my wife and kick my dog. But it is impossible. It is impossible for me to have felt the way that I felt and lived the way that I lived, and for me today to feel the way that I feel and live the way that I live today. It is impossible. In fact, in order for that to happen, it would take a miracle. Oh, that's the deal. See, that's the deal. See, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I threw myself in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's where I belong, in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. I threw myself in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, it has been able for me to turn into something different. It is able for me to become the person that I am. I want to read a little paragraph here if I can quickly enough find it. Because I think it's really, really important if you're new and if you're in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and if you feel like you don't belong, that I share this with you. Because I felt for a long time like I did not belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt for a long time alone and afraid in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I was dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says in A Vision for You, at the very end of the working text of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Take step 3. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Take steps 4 and steps 5. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Take steps 8 and steps 9. Give freely of what you find. Begin 12-step work. And join us. See, my problem is that I believe that paragraph should have said, join us, and then work the steps. And then join us is what it says. That's what it says. In our traditions, it says in the short form, which I must admit I don't like very much, but in the short form it says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are clubs in Portland for which the only requirement for membership is that you are a white male. I am a white male, and I am a member of none of them. But I meet the requirements. If you have a desire to stop drinking, you meet the requirements. It's our only requirement. But I suggest that you abandon yourself to God. Admit to Him and your fellows your faults. Clear away the wreckage of your past. And then, after giving freely of what you found, you can join us. My name is Sheldon Fetty. I'm from the Specific Group in Las Vegas. My sobriety date is July the 17th of 1996. It's been a pleasure sharing some time with you guys. Thank you.